The 4,600 tons of sand, lead, and dolomite that had been flung into the damaged building from 200 meters in the air, combined with the impact of the initial explosions a week before, might have fatally compromised the foundations of the reactor. If the temperature of the molten fuel reached 2,800 degrees centigrade, they suspected it could begin burning through the reinforced concrete floor of the reactor vault. Pressed down from above, it could eat its way through the bottom of the vault into the basement of the building and deep into the earth below. This was the doomsday scenario of reactor accidents, the China syndrome. Although first envisioned by U.S. nuclear engineers, the China syndrome had been made infamous as the title of the hit Hollywood movie released less than a month before the accident at Three Mile Island. It starred Jane Fonda as an intrepid TV reporter, aghast to discover how a mass of melted uranium fuel might burn through the base of a faulty reactor in California and continue inexorably until it reached the other side of the world in China. And while this hypothetical nightmare defied the laws of physics, geology, and geography, if a core meltdown had begun in Chernobyl, the China syndrome posed two real threats. The first and most obvious was to the local environment. The power station sat just a few meters above the water table of the Pripyat River, and if the melted fuel penetrated that far, the consequences would be catastrophic. A whole range of toxic radionuclides would poison the drinking water not only supplied to Kiev, but also that of everyone in Ukraine who drew from the waters of the Dnieper River basin, some 30 million people in all, and beyond that, flow into the Black Sea itself. But the second threat was even more immediate and frightening to contemplate than the poisoning of the water table. The molten fuel would reach the Pripyat and the Dnieper only if it escaped the foundations of the building. Before that happened, it would have to pass through the steam suppression pools, the flooded safety compartments beneath reactor number 4. And some of the scientists feared that if the white-hot fuel made contact with the thousands of cubic meters of water held in the sealed compartments there, it would bring about a new steam explosion orders of magnitude larger than the first. This blast could destroy not only what remained of Unit 4, but also the other three reactors, which had survived the accident intact. Amounting to a gargantuan dirty bomb formed of more than 5,000 tons of intensely radioactive graphite and 500 tons of nuclear fuel, such an explosion could exterminate whatever remained alive inside the special zone and hurl enough fallout into the atmosphere to render a large swath of Europe uninhabitable for 100 years. On Friday, May 2, the new team ordered to replace Boris Shcherbina and the members of his government commission, led by Ivan Salayev and including Legasov's old rival Evgeny Velikov, arrived in Chernobyl from Moscow. By now, Shcherbina and his group were exhausted, and after 5 days of often reckless disdain for the intangible dangers surrounding them, thoroughly irradiated. The commission members had not been given iodine tablets or dosimeters until they had already been in the accident zone for 24 hours, and not everyone had bothered to use them. Now their eyes and throats were red and raw from exposure to radioactive dust. Some noticed their voices becoming high and squeaky, a strange side effect of alpha contamination. Others felt sick, their heads swam, and they became so agitated they could barely concentrate. On Sunday, May 4, when they eventually returned to Moscow, Shcherbina and the others were hospitalized and examined for symptoms of radiation sickness. They surrendered their clothes and expensive foreign-made watches, too contaminated to be saved, for burial. One of Shcherbina's assistants was showered 18 times in an attempt to remove the radioactive particles from his skin. Nurses shaved the heads of everyone, except for Shcherbina, who declared that such treatment was beneath the dignity of a member of the Council of Ministers of the USSR and assented only to a short trim. Yet despite his mounting radiation dose and the departure of his colleagues, Valery Legasov chose to stay behind in Chernobyl. By the end of Sunday, emissions from the reactor had reached 7 million curies, even higher than the day the helicopter operation had first begun. And now Legasov found himself at odds with Evgeny Velikov over how to respond. Like Legasov, Velikov had no direct experience with nuclear power reactors and arrived at the scene planning to learn on the job. His manner didn't impress the generals, who preferred the athletic and decisive Legasov, an avowed socialist, a Soviet leader in the traditional mold, to the portly academic with his Western friends and loud Czech shirts. but Velikov could count on his long-standing relationship with Gorbachev to guarantee a direct line to the General Secretary, who had already taken a personal dislike to Legasov, begun to suspect he wasn't being told the whole truth about the accident, and needed someone in Chernobyl he could trust. Now, in addition to their different personalities, the two scientists were divided by their approach to the threat of meltdown in Unit 4. Velikov had recently seen the China Syndrome, screened to a restricted audience in the physics department of Moscow State University just over a year before, and feared the worst. However, Legasov and the other nuclear specialists at the scene were unswayed by the Hollywood version of events. They believed the chances of a full meltdown were insignificantly small. The scientists still had little real idea what might be happening deep in the bowels of Unit 4. They had no reliable data from inside the burning reactor, and even their measurements of radionuclides escaping into the atmosphere had a 50% margin of error. They knew nothing about the state of the graphite and lacked a full inventory of the fission products being released by the fuel. They couldn't be certain if the zirconium was burning or how any of these elements might be interacting with the thousands of tons of different materials dropped from the helicopters. They did not know how hot nuclear fuel might react with an enclosed body of water, nor did they have any hypothetical models to help them. In the West, scientists had been simulating the worst-case scenarios of reactor meltdowns for 15 years in ongoing research that had only intensified after the disaster in Three Mile Island. But Soviet physicists had been so confident of the safety of their own reactors that they had never bothered indulging in the heretical theorizing of beyond-design-basis accidents. And appealing directly to Western specialists for help at this stage seemed unthinkable. Despite the growing atmosphere of alarm among the physicists at the burning reactor, the government commission and the Politburo remained determined to conceal the news of a possible meltdown from the world beyond the 30-kilometer zone. Velikov contacted the head of his research lab on the outskirts of Moscow and summoned his team to work over the May Day holiday weekend. The dozen scientists weren't given any details over the phone, and even when they reached the lab, they were told about the accident only in the most general terms. They were required to find out all they could about the potential speed of a reactor core meltdown, but they were all theoretical physicists, experts in the study of esoteric phenomena related to the interaction of lasers and solids, plasma physics, and inertial fusion. None of them knew anything about nuclear reactors, and the first thing they had to do was learn all they could about the RBMK-1000. They plundered the library for reference books on the properties of different radioisotopes, decay heat, and thermal conductivity, and commandeered the lab's suite of Soviet-built mainframe computers to begin making calculations. Meanwhile, as Velikov and Legasov disagreed about the risks of a meltdown, the graphite blazed on, and the temperature inside reactor number 4 continued to rise. Velikov called Gorbachev in Moscow. What was happening in Chernobyl was so secret he wouldn't be allowed to call his wife for 6 weeks, but when he needed to talk to the General Secretary, he could reach him on the car phone in his limousine right away. "Should we evacuate Kiev?" Gorbachev asked. Velikov admitted that he just couldn't be sure. The new leader of the government commission, Ivan Salayev, a hero of socialist labor and holder of 2 Orders of Lenin, a long-serving technocrat with a direct manner and a steep crest of silver hair swooping back from his forehead, was less volatile than Boris Shcherbina. But he faced an even more dire situation than his predecessor had. The fire, the escaping radiation, the core meltdown, and now the possible explosion. He began demanding updates from the scene every 30 minutes. The members of the commission started work at 8 a.m. and finished at 1 a.m. Many slept for only 2 or 3 hours a night. In his headquarters in Chernobyl town, Salayev adopted a typically Soviet approach to the crisis. Rather than choose a single course of action to halt the possible meltdown, he gave orders for dynamic action and patriotic sacrifice on all fronts at once. He issued instructions to the plant staff to find a way of piping nitrogen gas into the reactor vault to blanket the melting core and starve the graphite fire of oxygen. He summoned subway construction engineers from Kiev to begin drilling into the ground below Unit 4 to freeze the sandy soil with liquid nitrogen or ammonia and protect the water table from the melting fuel. And he sent out word to find men brave enough to enter the darkened basement rooms directly beneath the reactor itself, open the valves of the steam suppression pool, and pump out the 5,000 cubic meters of highly radioactive water they would find there. In the meantime, General Antoshkin's helicopter assault on reactor number 4 continued. At 1 a.m. on Saturday, May 3, Captain Pyotr Zabrowski of the 427th Red Banner Mechanized Regiment of the Civil Defense had just finished washing in the field bathhouse in his camp 30 kilometers south of the plant. He was toweling himself dry when he got word that someone was looking for him. A colonel and a major general approached. He had never seen either of them before. "Get ready," the general said. "The head of the government commission wants to see you." Zabrowski, at 36, was a 16-year veteran of disaster remediation, nicknamed Los, Moose, on account of his physical strength. He had so far spent 3 days with his men in clouds of whipping dust and downdraft, heaving sacks of sand and clay into the parachutes beneath Antoshkin's helicopters. He hadn't eaten since breakfast the previous morning and was looking forward to a medicinal dose of 100 grams of vodka. "I'm not going anywhere until I have dinner," Zabrowski said. "We'll wait," the general replied. The steam suppression pools lay deep in the warren of claustrophobic spaces beneath reactor number 4. They were contained in a single massive concrete tank with a volume of 7,000 cubic meters, split into two stories, cluttered with a forest of thick pipework, partitioned into corridors and compartments, and half filled with water. The pools had been part of the main reactor safety system intended to prevent a steam explosion in the event of a pressure channel rupture inside the core. In an emergency, the escaping steam was supposed to be released through safety valves and directed down into the pools, where it would bubble up through the water, condensing harmlessly into liquid as it did so. But on April 26, the condensation system had been quickly overwhelmed and failed during the final destruction of reactor number 4. Now, neither the station staff nor the scientists knew how much water the tanks contained, or even if they remained intact. Technicians from the plant had opened one valve connected to the system and heard only the whistling of air rushing in. But the scientists nevertheless suspected that there was still water in the tanks. An order went out to find a good spot for blasting a hole through the wall, almost 2 meters thick and sheathed in stainless steel, using explosives. When this command reached a shift foreman at Unit 3, he suggested that there might be a less potentially catastrophic method of accomplishing the task. Examining the plant blueprints, he identified a pair of valves intended to drain the tanks for maintenance, located deep in the subterranean maze beneath the reactor, and scouted the route with a flashlight and a DP-5 military dosimeter. Before the accident, opening the valves would have been a simple task. Walk down a staircase to level minus 3, 3 meters below ground level, to corridor 001, a long concrete passageway connecting units 3 and 4, find the valve compartment, and turn the wheels on valve numbers 4GT21 and 4GT22. But now, radioactive water flooded corridor 001. In the valve compartment, it was 1.5 meters deep. When he reached that point, the shift foreman's DP-5 ran off the scale and there was no telling how much radiation lay inside. The valves could not be opened until the corridor had been cleared. It was still the small hours of the morning when Moose Zabrowski was shown into the meeting room on the second floor of the Government Commission headquarters in Chernobyl. Deputy Minister Salayev came out from behind his desk and stood to attention, his thumbs on the seams of his pants. "Comrade Captain, you have an order from the government to pump water out from under Unit 4. Zabrowski didn't have a chance to think. "Yes, sir." "You'll be given details by military headquarters," Salayev said. "Be ready at 0900. Only on his way back down the stairs did the captain consider the latest conditions reported near Unit 4. 2,800 Rentgen an hour beside the outer wall of the reactor. He had been taught in military technical school that 700 rem was a lethal dose. At the wall, he'd get that in 15 minutes. How much radiation would there be beneath the core itself? Zabrowski drove the 100 kilometers back to the civil defense base in Kiev to gather men and equipment, stopping at home on the way. Knowing that his clothes were highly contaminated, he stripped in the hallway before going inside his apartment. He kissed his sleeping 12-year-old son and said goodbye to his wife. He didn't tell her where he was going. Reporting back to Salayev at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning, the captain learned that the operation had to be planned from scratch. Even the elementary questions of how to get into the basement of Unit 4 to get the water out and where it could go once removed had not been considered. At the meeting of the government commission that morning, the experts couldn't agree on a safe location for the storage of 5,000 cubic meters, enough to fill two Olympic swimming pools, of highly radioactive effluent. While he waited for a decision, Zabrowski scouted the site in an armored personnel carrier and found a place to break through the wall into the basement service tunnel. Once again fearing the consequences of using explosives so close to the damaged reactor, Zabrowski asked for volunteers from his company to go in with a sledgehammer. Five men stepped forward. The radiation was high. The captain estimated each of them could work for a maximum of 12 minutes. When they finally broke through, Zabrowski went into the basement with a rope tied around his waist like a deep-sea diver. He walked on through the blackness until his steps began to squelch. Gradually, the water level rose to a depth of more than 4 meters. It felt warm, 45 degrees centigrade, hot as bathwater, and reeked of hydrogen sulfide. Back in Moscow, Evgeny Velikov's team of theoreticians began conducting experiments to investigate the behavior of melting nuclear fuel. In the absence of real data from the plant, Velikov had arranged for boxes of papers on the phenomenon to be flown over from his contacts in the West, but the scientists were in too much of a hurry to read and synthesize the mountain of material. They decided it was quicker to do the research themselves. They worked around the clock and slept on the chairs in the office. In the lab, they heated metal cylinders and uranium fuel pellets with carbon dioxide lasers, laid them on pieces of concrete, and recorded the results. They sent samples to Kiev, where a specialist examined the interaction between uranium dioxide, molten heavy concrete, and sand. They quickly confirmed Velikov's worst fears. A mass of fuel weighing only 10 kilograms could generate enough heat to melt right through the reinforced concrete floor of the reactor vessel and then keep going, traveling downward as quickly as 2.5 meters a day. But they also found that the incandescent uranium could fuse with and absorb pieces of debris, metal, and sand to form entirely new substances, highly radioactive and possessed of as yet unknown characteristics. In Chernobyl, the commission remained paralyzed over where to send the radioactive water filling the suppression pools, and in the meantime, the temperature recorded in the reactor above it continued to rise. Salyev held meeting after meeting. Moose Zabrowski tried to sleep when he could, a few minutes at a time, as the arguments went on into the night, the academicians, generals, and politicians shouting over one another. In the middle of it all, Gorbachev phoned from Moscow, his voice loud enough to be heard by everyone in the room. "Well, have you made up your minds?" Meanwhile, the plant physicists, consumed with fear, wandered around like zombies, seized not by the long-term terrors of radiation, but by the imminent threat of the explosion that might kill them, and everyone for hundreds of meters in every direction, at any moment. Finally, after 2 days of deliberations, Zabrowski himself thought to ask the advice of one of the plant's senior engineers about the water. The technician described two open-air pools, perfect for the purpose, just outside Pripyat. To reach them from the basement of Unit 4 would require 1.5 kilometers of hoses, but each pool had a capacity of at least 20,000 cubic meters. Ominously, the temperature of the water in the basement had begun rising. It was now 80 degrees. And by 6 p.m. on Sunday, Legasov's readings from the reactor touched 2,000 degrees centigrade. Something was happening. They had to act quickly. 12. The Battle of Chernobyl. Shortly after 8 p.m. on the evening of Friday, May 2, President Ronald Reagan landed at Tokyo's Haneda Airport aboard Air Force One at the climax of a 10-day tour through Asia and the Pacific. He had arrived in Japan to attend the first-ever meeting of the G7 nations, including the leaders of Great Britain, France, Germany, and Canada. But from the beginning, the trip had been overshadowed by the nuclear disaster unfolding on the other side of the world. The first reports of the radiation detected over Sweden had reached Reagan aboard the presidential plane as he was leaving Hawaii on Monday, and his planned day off in Bali on Wednesday had been interrupted by a briefing on what U.S. intelligence knew so far about events at the Chernobyl plant. Since then, Soviet dissembling about the accident had metastasized into a global diplomatic and environmental crisis. From high-resolution spy satellite photographs taken over Ukraine, in which they could make out details as small as individual fire hoses laid in the direction of the reactor cooling canals around the plant, CIA analysts knew that the scale of the catastrophe was far greater than Moscow acknowledged. And officials at the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission had begun to suspect that at least one of the other reactors at Chernobyl was now threatened by the ongoing crisis at Unit 4. Yet Moscow had rebuffed Reagan's public offer of medical and technical assistance, and American nuclear experts could only speculate about what was really happening at the crippled plant. At the same time, Soviet attempts to suppress further details of the accident were unraveling. In a classified report to Gorbachev on May 3, Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze warned that continued secrecy was counterproductive and had already bred distrust not only in Western Europe, but also with friendly nations planning to embrace Soviet nuclear technology, including India and Cuba. Shevardnadze wrote that taking the traditional approach to the accident was also endangering Gorbachev's dream of brokering a historic nuclear disarmament initiative with the United States. Western newspapers were asking how a nation that couldn't tell the truth about a nuclear accident could be trusted to be honest about how many nuclear missiles it had. On the morning of Sunday, May 4, President Reagan broadcast his weekly radio address to the United States from his suite in the Hotel Okura. He talked about his summits in Southeast Asia, the need for an expansion in free trade, and the problems of international terrorism, alluding to the recent strike on Colonel Gaddafi's compound in Tripoli by F-111s of the U.S. Air Force, in retaliation for the Libyan-sponsored bombing of a disco frequented by American soldiers in Berlin. Reagan reiterated his sympathy for the victims of the accident and his offer of assistance, but then his tone hardened. He contrasted the openness of free nations with the secrecy and stubborn refusal of the Soviet government to inform the international community of the risks they shared from the disaster. A nuclear accident that results in contaminating a number of countries with radioactive material is not simply an internal matter, Reagan said in his folksy rasp. The Soviets owe the world an explanation. That day, radioactive rain fell on Japan before being carried eastward by the jet stream, out across the Pacific at an altitude of 9,000 meters and a speed of 160 kilometers an hour, toward the coasts of Alaska and California. The following afternoon, Monday, May 5, a delegation from the International Atomic Energy Agency landed in Moscow at the invitation of the Soviet government. The team, led by IAEA Director General Hans Blix, had been promised a full and honest accounting of what had been going on at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. In the hours before their arrival, the Politburo gathered once more inside the Kremlin to discuss the crisis. Among the 24 men around the table this time were Boris Shcherbina, the aged nuclear chieftain academician Anatoly Alexandrov, and Efim Slavsky, the pugnacious head of the Ministry of Medium Machine Building. Valery Legasov had flown in from Chernobyl to present his report in person. There was much to discuss. The outlook was grim. Prime Minister Nikolai Ryzhkov took the floor with a detailed analysis and described what he had seen on his visit to the accident zone 2 days earlier. The helicopter operation to extinguish the fire was proceeding successfully, he said, and the danger of a renewed chain reaction inside the wreckage had been averted so far. But the response of Soviet and local authorities to the accident had been marred by failure and incompetence. The extreme conditions revealed, in practice, a high degree of organization in some, and the absolute helplessness of others, he said. The evacuation of a zone extending to 30 kilometers around the plant was still underway, with 100,000 people already removed from the area, including two districts in Belarus. But the results of the initial operation had been chaotic. 5,000 or 6,000 people are simply lost, Ryzhkov said. Where they are now is unknown. The civil defense and the Ministry of Health had failed utterly in their responsibilities. There had been no clarity or plan. People leaving the evacuation zone had not even received blood tests for radiation exposure. The fiasco made a mockery of the USSR's decades of preparation for the consequences of nuclear war. I can only imagine what would have happened here had something more serious occurred, the Prime Minister said in disgust. So far, more than 1,800 people, including 445 children, had been hospitalized. More were expected. High levels of radioactivity now covered the Western Soviet Union, from Crimea in the south to Leningrad in the north, exceeding the natural background levels by 5 or 10 times in most places. The chief of chemical troops of the USSR had already gathered 2,000 men inside the evacuated zone and had been ordered to develop a decontamination plan. Ryzhkov had given instructions for a 30-kilometer dam to be constructed around the accident site to prevent spring rains from flushing contamination from the surface of the ground in the 10-kilometer zone into the Pripyat and Dnieper rivers. He suggested military engineers be given just 48 hours to complete the task. And now, the Prime Minister explained to his comrades, they must face the greatest threat of all, the reactor meltdown. The scientists had presented him with two possible prognoses for the molten fuel currently scorching its way toward the basement of Unit 4. The first was that the heat of radioactive decay could gradually dissipate on its own. According to their calculations, that might take months. The second scenario, presented by academician Legasov and old man Alexandrov, was much darker. In addition to Velikov's fear that reaching 2,800 degrees, the collision of the molten fuel with the water of the suppression pool could result in a blast of steam that would destroy the remains of Unit 4 and obliterate Unit 3, the academicians now warned Ryzhkov to consider a further possibility, a nuclear explosion with even more disastrous consequences. Next, Sherbina took the floor, and Legasov presented a technical breakdown of the obstacles they faced, the radiation releases, the burning graphite, the rising temperature of the melting core, and the need to act quickly. Alexandrov chimed in. There was disagreement and bickering. "Don't get carried away," Gorbachev's conservative deputy, Ligachev, told Sherbina. "You've got Rentgen and Milorentgen mixed up," Shcherbitsky, the Ukrainian Communist Party head, said to the deputy minister of hydrometeorology. Akhromeyev, chief of the Soviet General Staff, argued that they should blast through the wall of the suppression pools with a hollow-charged shell. Shadov, the minister of coal, said that such an approach was too dangerous. He suggested that if the water could be pumped out, his men would stabilize the spaces by filling them with concrete. "If necessary," he said, "we'll dig a mining tunnel under the building." Legasov concurred. They should excavate beneath the reactor to pump in nitrogen gas and cool it from below. He assured Gorbachev that there was no need yet to send out an emergency appeal for help from the West. If the worst should happen, the maximum evacuation zone would have to be extended no farther than 250 kilometers from the station. But Gorbachev had already spoken to Velikov, who had stayed behind in Chernobyl, and the General Secretary now believed that they were approaching a terrible denouement. In the event of another explosion, they might need to expand the exclusion zone to a radius of 500 kilometers. That would mean evacuating a vast area of one of the most densely populated regions of the USSR, relocating everyone living in the largest cities in both Belarus and Ukraine, including Minsk and Lvov. In Kiev, a city of more than 2 million people, the third largest in the USSR, the Republican authorities had begun quietly drawing up an evacuation plan, but were terrified of having to enact it. They foresaw mass panic and the looting of stores, apartments, and museums. Hundreds of people would be crushed in stampedes at the railway stations and airports. "We've got to pick up our pace and work around the clock," Gorbachev said. They had to act not merely as if they were at war, he explained, but as if they were under nuclear attack. "Time," he said, "is slipping away." They were still discussing what to do next when Sherbina received a message from beneath Unit 4. Captain Zabrowski's water pumping operation had begun. Zabrowski had set out for the plant with 20 men, recruited from civil defense companies and fire stations across the region. When they arrived on the scene, they found it eerily silent, deserted except for the skeleton staff of operators tending to Units 1, 2, and 3. Abandoned equipment surrounded the chaos of debris near reactor number 4. The fire trucks, left behind by their colleagues more than a week before, too irradiated to be recovered, were now dented and smashed, hit by mistimed loads of lead and sand released by Antoshkin's helicopters. Although the air offensive had been halted temporarily, a thin column of smoke or vapor rose into the air from the rubble. Pieces of graphite littered the ground, still lying where they had been thrown by the explosion, shimmering in the hot sun. Back at their base in Kiev, the fire crews had tried deploying hoses onto the ground from a helicopter to reduce the time the firemen would have to spend in the high radiation zone near the reactor. But these experiments had failed, so the men would have to string out 1.5 kilometers of hoses by hand. They drilled again and again, practicing their routes and shaving seconds off the time it took to put them together and attach them to the special Zill fire trucks, equipped with powerful pumps that could move 110 liters of water a second. At first, Captain Zabrowski wasn't afraid of what lay ahead. After all, he thought, his commanders would never have given him an assignment that they knew was certain to kill him. Only when he entered the plant did he begin to comprehend the threat he faced. The staff there had already seen many of their friends flown out for treatment in the special clinic in Moscow, and they looked at him with the pity reserved for a condemned man. The specialists and management from the plant who had remained behind to man the station were still nominally led by Director Viktor Bruhanov and his chief engineer, the once bombastic Nikolai Fomin. The two men continued to sit by their phones in the dimly lit bunker beneath the plant, awaiting instructions from the government commission. But they were wrung out by exhaustion, radiation exposure, and shock. Fomin had remained in the bunker for 5 days, curling up to sleep beside the humming equipment in the ventilation room. Since the final evacuation of Pripyat, Bruhanov and the other operators had been sent to live in a pioneer camp 30 kilometers from the plant site named Skazochny, or Fairy Tale. A summer camp where the children of the nuclear workers could spend part of their long school vacations, Skazochny was a settlement of small brick and timber dormitories built deep in the forest, decorated with whimsical sculptures of dragons, sea creatures, and characters from Slavic myth. Now the woods and fields nearby were crammed with ambulances, cars, fire engines, and military vehicles. A dosimetric checkpoint stood at the entrance gate. All over the camp, hanging on the fences and plastered across the windows of the canteen, was a sea of notes, messages written by plant workers seeking their wives and children, displaced families from Pripyat announcing the names of the villages where they could be found, and pleas for information about relatives who had been lost amid the frenzy of evacuation. While Captain Zabrowski and his men prepared their pumping operation, the other parallel efforts to arrest the meltdown had also begun. First, the subway engineers arrived from Kiev and dug a large pit in the ground beside reactor number 3. Using specialized Japanese-built drilling equipment, they began to bore horizontally toward Unit 4 with the intention of creating a series of parallel holes 140 meters long running beneath its foundation. The engineers hoped that these would then carry narrow pipes bearing liquid nitrogen, which would freeze the ground, halting the progress of any melting nuclear fuel before it reached the water table. At the same time, technicians from the power station embarked on Legasov's plan to extinguish the burning reactor with nitrogen gas. The idea was to use the plant's existing pipe network, which before the accident had distributed the various gases used in plant maintenance, to help direct the nitrogen through the basement and into the ruins of the reactor hall. From the outset, the members of the plant staff executing this scheme recognized that it was pointless. The pipework in the area beneath the reactor was almost certainly damaged, and even if it reached the reactor hall, the nitrogen couldn't hope to starve the fire of oxygen because the building had no roof. Instead of concentrating around the burning graphite and displacing air from the flames, the gas would just drift uselessly into the atmosphere. But orders were orders. Salayev's government commission sent out instructions for all the available liquid nitrogen in Ukraine to be rerouted to Chernobyl by truck and by rail. The two massive vaporizers needed to turn the liquid into gas were located at the Cryogenmash plant in Odessa and flown to the airport in Chernikov, while a special shed to accommodate them was constructed near the administrative block of the power station. When they arrived, carried by a pair of Antoshkin's giant Mi-26 flying cow helicopters, the machines proved too large to fit through the door of the shed. The operators had to smash a larger opening with hammers. At 8 p.m., the technicians reported to Salayev that pumping could begin as soon as the nitrogen arrived. It was due that night, but the next morning there was still no sign of it. The operators waited all day. At 11 p.m., Director Bruhanov received a phone call from Salayev. "Find the nitrogen," the commission chairman said, "or you'll be shot." Accompanied by a detachment of troops, Bruhanov managed to locate the convoy of tanker trucks 60 kilometers away in Ivankov. The drivers, apparently terrified by the spectral horrors of radiation, had stopped in their tracks and refused to go any farther. Soldiers with machine guns took up positions at each end of the convoy, and the drivers were at last persuaded to deliver their cargo at gunpoint. It was 8 in the evening on Tuesday, May 6, when Moose Zabrowski's men finally pulled on military respirators and L-1 chemical protection suits, the heavy, rubberized overalls designed for combat during nuclear war, and drove out toward reactor number 4. Zabrowski had conducted his own radiation survey and calculated where they could go and for how long. The gamma fields varied wildly from 50 Rentgen in places near Unit 1 to the most dangerous areas, no more than 250 meters from Unit 4, where exposure reached 800 Rentgen. The men stopped the trucks inside the transport corridor, the large passageway beneath the reactor through which rail cars delivered fresh fuel for the plant. They ran out the hoses in just 5 minutes, a third of the regulation time, and started the pumps. Leaving the engines running, they closed the gates of the transport corridor behind them and sprinted to a nearby bunker. At last, the water level in the basement began falling. From the posts beneath the station, Bruhanov and Fomin telephoned Salayev, who relayed the news to Moscow. Every few hours, three men raced out to top off the trucks with gas and oil. Two others were sent to take readings of the radiation and the water temperature every 60 minutes. At 3 in the morning on Wednesday, a pair of firemen ran into the bunker to report that the hoses were ruptured. A team of chemical troops conducting radiation reconnaissance in the dark had driven over them in an armored personnel carrier, cutting them in 20 places and crushing the gaskets connecting them together. Radioactive water was gushing onto the ground just 50 meters from the reactor. Two sergeants sprinted out to repair the breaks. They needed 20 new sections of hose. Each section took 2 minutes to replace. They worked on their knees in a widening pond of gamma-emitting water. The two-fingered rubber mittens of their L-1 suits were clumsy and hot. They threw them off and used their bare hands. An hour later, the task complete, the men retired, exhausted, with an odd taste of sour apples in their mouths. The pumping went on all night and into the next day. After 14 hours of continuous operation, one truck's engine coughed to a halt. It had to be replaced. Zabrowski's men were all frightened. One was sent back to the Chernobyl fire station to fetch a case of medicinal vodka, but lost his nerve on the way and never returned. Another began ranting incoherently and was taken to the hospital, vomiting. When it was Moose's turn again to take the radiation readings, he instructed a firefighting captain to come with him in case he passed out or lost his way inside the building. The officer refused.
"Don't bring out the beast in me, you bastard," Zabrowski roared, "or I'll have my troops tie you up and throw you out beside Unit 4. 15 minutes out there and you won't be able to utter another word."
The officer climbed into a rubber suit and did as he was told. 140 kilometers away, details of what had happened at the plant had begun seeping into Kiev. The news spread by word of mouth and via the warbling Enemy Voices, the Russian-language radio programming broadcast into the Soviet Union by the BBC, Radio Sweden, and Voice of America, or at least those that KGB jamming could not disrupt. Waves of rumor and anxiety rippled through the city. The Surveillance Department of the Ministry of Internal Affairs, the MVD, reported on wild speculation about the number of victims of the accident and the contamination of air and water. One informant overheard a taxi driver describing how Pripyat had been evacuated amid chaos and looting, which even government troops had been unable to control. That a government minister was among those killed, that pregnant women were being induced to have abortions, and that the Dnieper was already completely radioactive. Soviet authorities were still assuring the public that the danger from the plant was confined to the 30-kilometer zone. But the streets of Kiev had been emitting gamma radiation for days, as hot particles carried in fallout from the reactor melted slowly into the surface of the asphalt. Shcherbitsky, the Ukrainian Communist Party chief, knew that the radiation dose rates in the city had increased steeply. And radioactive iodine in the water of the Dnieper River basin had indeed reached levels 1,000 times higher than normal. Meanwhile, the head of the Ukrainian KGB warned that the numbers of casualties ascribed to the accident being broadcast on TV by Moscow and by Kiev were sharply contradictory. But his colleagues procrastinated about what and when to tell the people. Finally, on Tuesday, May 6, 10 days after the crisis began, the Ukrainian health minister appeared on local radio and TV to warn Kievans to take precautions against radiation, to remain indoors, close their windows, and protect themselves against drafts. By then, word had gone around that senior party members had quietly sent their children and grandchildren to the safety of pioneer camps and sanatoria in the south. Days earlier, at a central Kiev pharmacy favored by members of the Ukrainian Central Committee, the doctor and writer Yuri Sherbak had discovered a long queue of well-to-do pensioners waiting patiently to buy stable iodine. Worse still, rumors had also leaked of the possibility of a devastating second explosion at the plant and the government's secret contingency plan for the total evacuation of the city. Many people recognized the state's reassuring official statements as hollow propaganda. That evening, crowds gathered at the railway station as thousands of people attempted to escape the city. Men and women spent the night sleeping on the concourse to keep their places in line for tickets. The Soviet internal passport system prevented most citizens from leaving their areas of registration without good reason, so many workers hurriedly applied for vacations. Some who were refused simply quit their jobs in desperation. Fleets of orange street cleaning trucks soon appeared to start what would become an incessant effort to wash hot fallout from the city streets. By then, crowds had begun to form outside the city's banks, some of which were forced to close just a few hours after opening. Others limited withdrawals to 100 rubles per person. By afternoon, many banks had run out of money. When the pharmacies sold out of stable iodine pills, people resorted to drinking tincture of iodine, intended for use as an external antiseptic, burning their throats. Lines outside liquor stores quadrupled in length as people sought protection from radioactivity with red wine and vodka, forcing the Ukrainian Deputy Minister of Health to announce, "There is no truth to the rumor that alcohol is useful against radiation." By Wednesday, crowds of frantic Kievans were fighting for tickets out of the city, struggling to flee in numbers not seen since the German Blitzkrieg swept east in 1941. At the railway station, men and women thrust fistfuls of rubles directly into the hands of the coach attendants, pressed into four-seat compartments 10 at a time, and climbed into the luggage racks. Others attempted to make their escape by road, and traffic choked the southern routes from the city. Almost 20,000 people left by car or bus in one day alone. The government added extra flights at the airport and doubled the number of trains leaving Kiev for Moscow, where Western reporters witnessed rail cars arrive packed with unaccompanied children, eyes wide and noses flattened against the windows, their relatives waiting anxiously on the platform. Fearing mass panic, aware of the simmering crisis at the plant, the Ukrainian Prime Minister began to consider an organized evacuation of every child in the city. But the government commission in Chernobyl had provided no directives on the matter, and nobody in the Republican apparat really wanted to bear responsibility for taking such a drastic step, which, quite impossible to conceal or suppress, would telegraph to the outside world just how terrifying the situation had become. The Prime Minister needed expert advice. He asked for the Kremlin's respective mandarins of radiation medicine and meteorology, Leonid Ilyin and Yuri Israel, to be sent to Kiev for an urgent consultation. In Moscow, the Western fact-finding team from the International Atomic Energy Agency, the Director General, former Swedish diplomat Hans Blix, and the American Morris Rosen, Director of Nuclear Safety, had been granted permission to see the plant in person, and became the first officials from outside the Soviet Union to visit the scene. They were due to fly into Kiev on Thursday, May 8. When Evgeny Velikov heard the news, he was horrified. The academician asked Deputy Minister Salayev to call Gorbachev with a message. "Tell him that our outhouse is overflowing and they'll have to climb a mountain of shit." It wasn't until around 4 in the morning on Thursday that the taps in the valve compartment began to emerge from beneath the contaminated water in Corridor 001. Deputy Minister Salayev insisted that men be sent in to open them immediately. But the basement was filled with kilometers of pipework, and all the valves looked the same. It was pitch black. Only someone with intimate knowledge of the network of narrow, darkened rooms could hope to navigate the task and emerge safely. Three men from the Chernobyl station staff were selected for the job. Two to open the valves and one to escort them in case anything went wrong, and issued with wetsuits, personally driven over to the plant by a Ukrainian deputy minister. Clutching wrenches and flashlights, with pencil dosimeters clipped to their chests and to their ankles at water level, they stepped into the basement shared between units 3 and 4. Boris Baranov, chief shift manager for the plant, went first, followed by two engineers, Alexei Ananenko and Valery Bespalov. As they descended the stairwell toward level minus three, Baranov stopped to take a reading in the corridor leading beneath Unit 4. He extended the telescopic arm of his DP-5 to its maximum and held the sensor out into the darkness. The decimeter immediately ran off the scale on every one of its ranges. There was nothing else for it. "Move quickly," Baranov said, and the three men took off at a sprint. As he ran, one of the engineers couldn't help himself and looked back. He glimpsed a giant cone of something black and crumbling, mixed with fragments of concrete, material that had spilled into the passageway from the shattered building above. His tongue tingled with the metallic taste of liquid radiolysis. The route down to the entrance of Corridor 001 had been surveyed by a dosimetrist with a DP-5 radiometer, who took his final measurement directly above the surface of the water in the corridor. Beyond that, the basement remained a dangerous mystery. No one knew how much water it contained or how radioactive it became as they moved deeper inside. Exposure increased with every moment spent in the tunnel. Each second counted. Baranov kept watch as the two engineers went in. The space was eerily silent. The slosh of the water parting around their feet resounded from the low ceiling, their ears filled with the sound of their own ragged breathing, stifled by their damp pedal respirators. But the men discovered that the water was now only ankle deep and found a large diameter pipe running along the floor, wide enough to walk on. The valves themselves were intact and labeled clearly. Numbers 4GT21 and 4GT22 opened easily. A few moments later, Ananenko recognized the sound of water gurgling from the suppression pools above their heads. By dawn on May 8, the imminent threat of a second catastrophic explosion from beneath the reactor had been averted. Soon afterward, an official in civilian clothes sought out Moose Zabrowski at his post in the bunker and handed him an envelope sent from the government commission. Inside, he found 1,000 rubles in cash. The academician's relief at the emptying of the suppression pools was brief. While the efforts of the soldiers and the engineers headed off the possibility of a devastating steam explosion, the threat to the water table remained, and the scientists' fear of the China syndrome only intensified. Some estimates now suggested that if it melted through the foundations of Unit 4, an incandescent mass of fuel might sink as far as 3 kilometers into the earth before stopping. The metro builders from Kiev had already begun drilling toward the reactor, hoping to freeze the soil with liquid nitrogen, but their efforts were hampered by rain, dust, and highly radioactive debris. They were repeatedly stopped by massive underground obstacles not shown on the plant blueprints, including the foundation plates of the cranes used during the station's construction. Precious drill bits snapped, and they had to start again at ever greater depths. At the same time, Salayev gave orders to begin pumping gaseous nitrogen into the steam suppression pools, while more men were directed into the basement as part of a plan to fill them with liquid concrete as soon as they had been emptied of water. And by the end of the week, the Politburo had granted permission for the most desperate measures yet. Soviet diplomats were reported to have approached the German Atom Forum, West Germany's leading nuclear industry group, requesting foreign help. The Soviet emissaries did not provide any specific details of the problem at hand, but said they urgently required guidance on how to handle something extremely hot that may have melted through the nuclear plant floor. In their lab outside Moscow, the scientists at Velikov's laboratory continued their round-the-clock research into the properties of molten uranium dioxide, with instructions from the Politburo to reach the most conservative possible prognosis of the meltdown. The physicists worked alongside two separate groups of mathematicians who sat at their computers day and night to test their theories. Running an entire cycle of a single testing algorithm took between 10 and 14 hours, so a colleague sat beside each mathematician to correct his mistakes when he flagged or wake him when he fell asleep. Only when the two groups' results matched could they be confident of their conclusions. They were aghast at the results. If the molten fuel spread out over a large enough area, forming a layer no more than 10 centimeters thick, it would begin cooling faster than it could melt soil or concrete, and eventually stop moving and solidify on its own. But they also found that the new substance believed to be oozing from the melting reactor core a slurry of uranium dioxide mixed with sand, zirconium, and lead, forming a man-made radioactive lava, or corium, could behave in unexpected ways. If it was covered from above, for example by several thousand cubic meters of liquid concrete, the heat of radioactive decay would be trapped and the corium would melt down even more quickly. And while, in theory, using a series of pipes to freeze the earth beneath the melting fuel might stop its progress, the computer model revealed that it would do so only within strict limits. If the cooling pipes were any more than 4 centimeters apart, the corium could simply divide into separate tongues and burn through the spaces between them before coalescing on the other side into a single mass, like some primitive but resourceful new life form, to continue its relentless downward path. The scientists realized that the efforts of the Metro engineers were doomed to failure, and the attempt to fill the suppression pools with concrete must be stopped. The scientists no longer saw themselves as cloistered academics working in the esoterica of pure physics, but as the only men standing between the ignorant fools in Chernobyl and a global disaster. Folding a dot matrix printout of the computer simulation into his luggage, Vyacheslav Pizmeny, the head of the lab, took the next available flight aboard a Yak-40 executive jet to Kiev. On the morning of Thursday, May 8, only hours after water had begun to empty from the steam suppression pools beneath reactor number 4, Hans Blix and Morris Rosen of the IAEA embarked from Moscow for their visit to the Chernobyl station. They were met at the airport in Kiev by Evgeny Velikov, and together they flew northwest by helicopter. It was hot inside the aircraft, and they were all sweating in their green overalls. The plant grew steadily closer. Rosen, a veteran administrator from the U.S. nuclear industry, asked Velikov what range he should set on his dosimeter.
"About 100," Velikov replied.
"Millerentgen?"
"No, Rentgen."
Rosen looked queasy. His device wasn't designed for such high radiation exposures. But Velikov assured them that everything would be fine. His own Soviet-made meter could comfortably measure in that range, and besides, he made this flight himself every day. What the academician did not share with his American counterpart was how little he understood about the radiation levels around the plant. Velikov was particularly puzzled by why they did not fall as he expected when he moved away from Unit 4, declining more slowly than the inverse square law would suggest. Only later did he discover that on each flight they took, he and his fellow scientists were being exposed to powerful gamma fields, not just from the reactor below, but also from dozens of fuel fragments scattered across the platforms of the vent stack. Still, Velikov could afford, at last, some optimism. While the desperate work had continued to battle the meltdown beneath the reactor, the levels of radionuclides escaping into the air above it had suddenly started to fall, as steeply and inexplicably as they had begun rising 5 days before. As reactor number 4 came into view, Rosen and Blix could see a light trail of smoke drifting from the ruins, but the level of radioactive release, while still significant, was approaching zero, and the graphite fire was apparently all but extinguished. The temperature on the surface of the reactor had plunged from 2,000 degrees centigrade to just 300 degrees. Although the Soviet scientists were at a loss to comprehend exactly why, it seemed that, 13 days after it had begun, the emergency might be over at last. Even so, Rosen didn't want to take any chances. When the helicopter was still 800 meters out, Velikov asked if he'd like to get closer.
"No," the American said. "I can see perfectly from here."
At a press conference in Moscow the following day, Rosen told reporters that the graphite fire was out and that measurements taken during their helicopter flight revealed that there is relatively little radioactivity now. He felt confident there was no longer any risk of a meltdown. "The situation appears to be stabilizing," he said. "I can say that a very competent group of Soviet experts is working at the site. They have many very sensible ideas and are carrying out this work now, at this very moment." That Sunday, May 11, Moscow Central TV broadcast its first report from inside the 30-kilometer Chernobyl exclusion zone, including footage of masked policemen stopping traffic at roadblocks, deserted houses, and a well sealed with plastic. Upstairs in the headquarters of the government commission in the center of town, Velikov and Deputy Minister Salayev gave interviews. Sitting beneath a portrait of Lenin at a table in an echoing conference room surrounded by white-suited technicians conferring over maps and notebooks, Salyev appeared pale but jubilant. "We have come to the conclusion today that the primary, most important threat has been eliminated," he said, and sorted through a folder of aerial photographs of the reactor until he found one taken that day. "This is the latest," he said. "As you can see, this shows a completely calm state. You can see no smoke here, and certainly no glowing spots. This is, of course, a historic event. What was predicted by the world, and particularly by the bourgeois newspapers in the West, which shouted from the rooftops that an enormous catastrophe was imminent, is no longer a threat. We are firmly convinced the danger is past." Back in Moscow, the theoretical physicists continued to insist that the molten corium still moving somewhere deep inside reactor number 4 remained a terrible threat. But there was fierce disagreement about their findings. The atomic specialists from the Kurchatov Institute and Sredmash dismissed them as the opinions of academic interlopers who lacked any practical experience in nuclear reactors. They argued that it was almost certain that the corium would stop melting through the basement levels of Unit 4 long before it reached the deepest foundations of the building. And the theoreticians agreed that this scenario was indeed the most likely, but it was by no means guaranteed. They calculated that the chances of a ball of radioactive lava searing through all four of the 1.8-meter-thick reinforced concrete floors beneath the reactor and reaching the water table of the fourth-longest river in Europe were as high as 1 in 10. In their formal report, the theoreticians advised that the only guaranteed defense against the China syndrome was an audacious construction project to be launched in the most perilous circumstances imaginable. They recommended the excavation of a chamber deep beneath Unit 4, about 5 meters high and 30 meters square, designed to house a massive, purpose-built water-cooled heat exchanger, which would chill the earth and stop the molten corium in its tracks. To illustrate the nature of the threat they were facing, Pismeny, the head of the lab, arrived at a meeting at Sredmash headquarters in Moscow, carrying a large chunk of concrete, melted during their experiments, a deformed pellet of uranium dioxide still embedded within it. The Sredmash construction chief apparently needed no more convincing. "Build it," he said. 13. Inside Hospital Number 6.
Two steps back, otherwise I will not talk to anyone. Two steps back."
The chief economist of the Pripyat City Council climbed onto a stool and surveyed the mob that packed the small room and the hallway beyond, snaking down the stairs and into the street outside. Normally a sweet-natured woman with an easy laugh, Svetlana Kirichenko had now spent days marooned in Polyeskoy, a small town with rutted streets, a modest square, and a monument to Lenin, about 50 kilometers west of the Chernobyl station. She and the handful of remaining staff from the Pripyat Ispolkom had set up an office in the Polyeska town hall and were now facing the wrath and confusion of their exiled citizenry. The frustrated crowd pressed forward, demanding to see the mayor. They set bawling children on her desk. They asked what they could do with sick grandparents and when they would receive their salaries. Above all, they wanted to know when they could return home. By the time night fell on Sunday, April 27, at least 21,000 people had been swept from their modern apartments in Pripyat and dropped off by bus in more than 50 small towns and villages scattered across the sodden flatlands of northwestern Ukraine. Told they would need to prepare for only 3 days away from home, the uprooted families soon ran out of food, money, and clean clothes, and then discovered that even what they had thought was clean was not. When a dosimetrist set up an improvised monitoring station at a desk in the street outside the Polyeska town hospital, a line of evacuees formed in front of him. The queue moved quickly, but never seemed to shorten. Touching his monitoring device to the clothes, hair, and shoes of one person after another, the dosimetrist chanted a slow mantra in a tired, flat voice. "Clean. Contaminated. Contaminated. Clean. Shake out your clothes downwind. Clean. Contaminated. Contaminated. Contaminated." At first, many of the peasant families who took in the evacuees were kind and hospitable, and they made the best of it. Viktor Bruhanov's wife, Valentina, a trained engineer, was lodged with a laboratory chief on a collective farm in the village of Razvazhev, where she took to milking cows. but Valentina had been separated from both her pregnant daughter and her mother during the evacuation and had no idea what had befallen her husband or where any of them might be, and had no way of finding out. 30 kilometers away, Natalia Yuvchenko and her 2-year-old son Kirill were among the 1,200 refugees who had been billeted among the clay and thatch homes of Lugoviki,